Welcome to the first episode of the highly played game of As If. It's a podcast designed to look at creativity in a new way in light of sacred texts. And we're going to begin with a look at some of the Gospels. I don't know how many episodes we'll devote to that, but that seems to be a set of stories that is familiar to us in particular in the Western world. I'm one of your hosts, Philip, and Matt's along with me.
Hey, everybody.
So I think it might be helpful to just start out with what we mean by the highly played game of As If, and we'll try to do this succinctly.
Okay.
It's derived from a quote by Joseph Campbell in his book Primitive Mythology, and he is referring to something Immanuel Kant said, and I'll just read the quote real quick from Kant, which is that the proper expression for our fallible mode of conception would be that we imagine the world as if its being and inner character were derived from a supreme mind. So, the game of As If is this sort of creative imagination. And when I sat down and really thought about what he means by our fallible mode of conception, it occurred to me that the thing in my mind that sets, you know, the human mind apart from anything else and makes it wholly unique is this idea that it can conceive orders of scale, meaning that it can extrapolate cause and effect in a way that, you know, your dog certainly couldn't. And what happens when we engage in that is that ultimately we come up against a barrier because we can only know so much. And so we either have to become distracted from that line of thought, or we have to extrapolate something. We have to imagine something or make something up.
I think you and I both know what it's like to pound down that road, and for reasons of trying to be honest about, you know, what is known and what's possibly what we could possibly know. So for epistemological reasons, also for reasons of being teachers and what we advise people, wanting that to be based on something that doesn't exclude rationality, that at least has some relation to it, but also maybe is not limited, you know, completely, you know, by that. And so the As If game is very, really interesting to me, you know, being someone who is as interested in science and especially the spirit, you know, of science and the spirit of debate and the spirit of openness and the spirit of demonstration. And to come up against the absolute limit of that and, you know, still not be free of the idea that there's more, that there's further to go, but we're not left with a method at that point if we keep relying on the same way of being for going any further. So it's really refreshing here, you know, to hear Kant and to hear Campbell not disregard that way of being, because I know neither of them disregarded that way of demonstration and rationality and those things, but they seem to be able to deal with this impulse that we can't stop feeling that there's more than that in a way that satisfies our intellectual curiosity and also our honesty.
Right, and I think what's interesting is, and what's really important to understand about the game of As If and how it differs from something like theology or at least the institutionalized versions of theology or doctrine that we're used to, and also rational science on the other side, is that it's sort of a middle ground, you know, because I think what Campbell is saying with the idea of this highly played game of As If is that on the one side, on either side, you have basically absolutes. You have science on the one side saying this is it, and if we can't measure it and we can't talk about it in rational terms, then it doesn't exist. And then on the other side, you have theologians, or you have this doctrine that basically claims to be able to talk about something that's beyond explanation in rational terms.
Uh-huh.
So the game of As If is sort of in the middle and frees you from the need for absolutes.
So would you say that it, as by virtue of its being in the middle, that we somehow we have this dialectical relationship between those two particular modes of thinking, the mode that says there's a certain set of criteria that you must use in order to relate to what is expressible, and then there's a certain set of criteria that you use to relate to what is unexpressible, and you can't have one or the other, you have to have both to some degree. So it'll be interesting to me, you know, just right off the bat in clarifying what this game of as if is. I mean, we could say it in simple terms. We could say, okay, we're relating to mythic language, and that's how you play the game of as if. But, you know, deep down, if we bring something from the scientific attitude to the game of as if, and we bring something from the creative attitude to the game of as if, and they're both there, you know, what that clarifies for me what this way of being is. And so the phrase as if is pretty demonstrable there to me. So we know that we're not doing science because the phrase as if says this is not an objective truth. But we can proceed about the way that we investigate whatever it is we're investigating with the same rigor we would use in science. We can keep the overarching feeling of intellectual honesty, and we can limit ourselves from being tempted as if these were objective truths, because I think that temptation is there, and that's the temptation that theology has given into. Right. If you are doing that, but what comes from the creative side? A way of, this is vague and maybe you can help, but a way of relating to this impulse that keeps coming up inside us that says right. There has to be more. Keep seeing and sensing this stuff, if you will, about reality that I know science can't really take into account, but I can't stop feeling.
So this would be a good time also to point out that, you know, what we're going to be doing is we're going to be looking at the sacred text, and the reason that this is particularly applicable in this game of as if, the highly played game of as if, is the Kant quote that we mentioned earlier says that the proper expression of our fallible conception, right, is to imagine as if our inner character were derived from a supreme mind. So there are other ways to play the game and other frameworks within which to be, but if we're going to follow Kant's advice and do something proper with our mode of conception, then what we might do is imagine that we have some divine seed or some, you know, supreme source. And again, the terminology is going to differ from time and place, but what we see and what is illustrated through the sacred text is that time and again these same images continue to come up, and we can't let go of them.
Mm-hmm.
They continue to arise, and we continue to hold on to them for dear life, you know. And so I think that in itself has some significance and bears, you know, some exploration.
So this is beginning to be a commentary on Jung.
Right.
Carl Jung a little
right.
bit here.
And so,
when we say,
so what we can talk about now is the language of myth, and particularly that it has two meanings. So just like as when we learn English in school, we learn that there's a denotative and a connotative meaning to a word. And so the denotative meaning is something we can all generally agree on. We can look it up in the, you know, dictionary, and we can point at it, and it's pretty well written, you know, in stone.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a connotative meaning, and the connotative meaning really is always going to trump the denotative meaning in terms of us being able to relate to each other, because that takes into account all kinds of different things, from, you know, cultural nuances that are related to particular time periods, as well as the words that are connected to each other in a sentence can change the meaning.
Could
all kinds of different
body
things.
Language.
Body language is part of that.
Basic vibe that's going on in the conversation. You know, it's real interesting. That's a real pregnant distinction in that sense when you say that the connotative meaning might only involve one of our faculties, primarily. If we were to say our senses, you know, just for lack of a better word, the denotative meaning might only involve one way of relating to meaning. But immediately, the connotative meanings, which we move about with probably more so than we do any other, it immediately takes all of our senses, and it's like a synesthesia of the way that we relate to people has to do with unconscious feeling and unconscious appreciation of where their vibe is, and no matter what the words, the letters that spell the words of what they're saying, we get this sense. It's like the denotative meanings have no context. They have one context.
One context.
And it's an objective context. And that's useful, obviously, right, for several things. But we probably spend as much time in the other way of being, maybe more time.
We probably rely more heavily on the connotative.
Probably.
Just to get by. I mean, just to relate to each other.
Because humans are definitely one of the only species, I would say, that can say things that they don't really mean.
Right.
And we can sense that and know that. And we can say things on purpose to not mean
that,
what we say.
Right.
And mean other things. And so what's interesting is that science doesn't want to have any truck with that way of being, even though we spend so much of our time in it. And I understand science's reasons, and I wholeheartedly, you know, embrace them for certain things, but it's an immediate devaluation of what we would call normal life.
Right,
general.
And I think what you said, earlier is definitely applies here, because I mean, we can still, even if we're talking about connotative meanings, we can still apply a certain methodology to our exploration of that might be considered scientific, or at least intellectually honest.
So intellectually honest is my phrase, or we can keep enough presence of mind to give pause to the impulses and excitement that arise in us, right, as we go through and we look at these kinds of things. So we have to embody this tension, which is a tension between dissent and assent. Right, what
right.
I assent to and what I dissent to internally.
And so those of you who are, you know, reading the blog will recognize this as the friction, you know, between yes
right.
and no.
Right.
That we talk about on the blog, and what is the driving force in the creative evolution process.
Mm-hmm.
So if we take the connotative and the denotative concepts and
right.
we apply them then to the language of the sacred text or the language of myth, we can see that there are, you know, kind of two levels of meaning within that. And there's going to be the denotative meaning, which is going to be the, you know, the words on the page and what, you know, they're saying literally, the literal meaning. And then there's going to be a connotative meaning, which, you know, the one of the main guys that, you know, kind of influenced the way we're going to look at the Gospels is a British psychologist named Maurice Nicole, and he would call the connotative meaning a psychological meaning.
Right.
And it would make sense to talk about right now where that psychological meaning comes from, because I think, you know, one of the pitfalls of doing this kind of exercise is that it's easy to go, well, it's easy to kind of assume that this is just one guy's opinion as to what this means, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we look at a particular passage and we, you know, say, well, this is what this refers to. I mean, an example would be water, you know, signifies truth in some way.
A certain level.
You know,
of
so,
truth, right?
but I mean, the temptation is to say, well, that's just an arbitrary, you know, designation in the mind of Matt or Philip or whatever. But I think that we can argue, and that Jung would argue, and that, you know, Campbell would argue, that there is something more to that, and that there is this, I mean, Jung's word was the collective unconscious, and we would argue that the psychological meaning is derived from that collective unconscious.
So we're going to try to make the case embracing our denotative instincts, you know, in part going through this, we're going to try to make the case that these are not just arbitrary distinctions. One of the things that I think the listener should know is that you and I have fully investigated the possibility that they're arbitrary extinctions. I think both of us have spent plenty of time doing what the modern era understands as deconstruction and all of those other ways of relating to language. And I think that we've also done plenty of looking at neurology and biology and social cognition and social perception and seeing a possible material basis to explain all of the impulses, you know, that we're going to talk about symbolically and mythically. And so this is not, in my mind, this is not lightly spoken at all. And there's a huge emotional significance to the things that we're going to be talking about, and I, despite all my rational investigation in nature, I can't intellectually remain honest and be dismissive of these things that Jung says and these things that Campbell say, because we go back a little bit earlier in the conversation, we're talking about what you said. There are these things in our experience, and not just Philip's experience and Matt's experience, but things that go back to cultures who never had any temporal contact with one another, and these themes keep coming up. And whether these themes are disguised in the newest Hollywood action flick, or whether they're disguised in Shakespeare, or whether they're disguised on the daily news as an interaction between people, we're talking about redemption and death and resurrection, and we're talking about all of those kinds of things, the emotional charge, the reason that stuff is still around is because it hooks into us and speaks to us on a level that surpasses the rational level before the rational level even gets a chance to say anything about it. It hooks into us at an emotional level, and I can't, you know, myself just ignore that.
Right. Neither can we ignore something like, you know, I mean, what we're going to be talking about is the Gospels. And I think, you know, your experience has been the same as mine, spending a long time kind of rejecting that because of this sort of literal translation approach that's been taken, you know. And for some reason, we can't leave it alone.
Well, yeah. And for some reason is a little bit vague. I think I have some I have some ideas, and we're going to go into that, I guess, as the blog goes. But I will say this, the attitude that defines all of those years of relating to the gospel is the scientific attitude. And that attitude isn't, in its strictest sense, as I understand it, an attitude of trying to prove something. That's an attitude of trying to disprove what can be disproven to see what, you know, remains. And so, we talked earlier before we started recording a couple of days ago, I spent a lot of time reading the history of first century Palestine and have talked to, in books and in reading, guys who are on both sides of the fence, guys who take these things as literal realities and their lives are hinged on it, and then people who, like Paul Tillich, who are in this mode more of interpreting things symbolically and seeing universal themes in them. And, you know, I have to say that no matter what, like you said, the feeling that is generated, the feeling that something extremely significant is going on here can't be done away with. And rather than having that, because I don't know what to do with it when I relate totally from the denotative side of it, that leaves me in sort of an existential crisis. But when we think of that this tension that I'm left with as a possibility for creativity and for inner psychological development, you know, now there's a constructive, empowering reason to continue to be involved with this, because it doesn't feel right just to put it down and turn and go the other way.
Right.
I'd feel like there was unfinished business.
Right. And this is where I think we, you know, this goes back to the Kant quote, as to say that the really moral or proper thing to do is to imagine the world as if, you know, its inner character were derived from a supreme mind.
And so we're left with creativity, and then where do we go from here? How is it that we read creatively?
Right.
How is it that we then behave creatively without rejecting rationality, without being ruled by it, right? I think that's...
And without just being completely on the other end.
Pollyanna, you know, you right. might say. That's a little bit normative. I want to be theologically positive, but,
fanatical.
Right, right. Because that offends me as much as just dropping this right. and not having any more involvement. It doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel honest. So there's a middle ground here. And what excites me about doing this is how does the notion of creativity relate to this? And can creativity, you know, be intellectually honest, number one? But number two, you know, what are the consequences of that for being human and for making your way in this world?
Right. So now we can maybe, you know, we can return to the collective unconscious, and we can kind of talk about where these images come from. And the quote from Jung is that the collective unconscious, or the primary image, is for him a memory deposit derived from a condensation of innumerable similar experiences. It's the psychic expression of an anatomically, physiologically determined natural tendency.
Right. Last part. Now say that again.
Okay. The psychic expression of an anatomically, physiologically determined natural tendency. So we talk about evolution a lot. Not just the creative part, but the mechanical part,
yeah,
you
Darwin.
Know, that happens in the Darwin thing, and that's definitely a reality. And that there's a particular method by which that happens, and that happens through passing on of DNA and through inherited traits of various kinds.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think what Jung is saying is that there is, you know, a deeper correlate to that, or a psychological correlate to that, that happens over time, and that is inherited.
Well, I think he's also trying to include the realm that Darwin wants to work in. When he's saying, what does he say, an anatomically...
A physiologically, anatomically determined natural tendency.
Right.
So it's a psychic expression of that.
Right, and so there's no...
So it's maybe, it's in a way instinctual, but on the psychological level.
Well, it's also not otherworldly.
Right.
Right, it's a marriage of what we would call our psychic life, what Dr. Campbell called the inward expression of being human, that's common to all of us, and that's not separate from the body. And so I think that's really, really important, because already, you know, we're collapsing these dualisms that have tended to haunt thought, you know, for a long time. And
really keep these kinds of discussions from happening.
And that's just one way, you know, to relate to things. And I'll go to science to relate to things at times in that way. But here we are, you know, talking a little bit differently about this. And so this would be a kind of genetically, physiologically based, inherited trait, you know, that all humans share. That's very, very interesting. It's a very old idea. It's probably older than, for instance, the Yoga Sutra, but the Yoga Sutra says exactly the same thing. It says a memory deposit. Is that what you
yep.
said in the beginning? Yeah, the Sanskrit word for that, the Yoga Sutra, is karmasayo,
right.
And it means the memory box, or the memory deposit, the place where experience is stored. It's obvious that experience is kind of stored in some way. I mean, that drives evolution, and memory is a reality. And so I guess to try to do away with this notion that this is just one guy's interpretation, or there's some arbitrariness, you know, we're not wanting to be dismissive of that idea. We've considered it, but to try to found this in some other way that's not arbitrary, we're saying that on some level, the sacred texts were authored by this common human experience or tendency, this unconscious, this memory deposit.
This condensation, it's a condensation of innumerable similar experiences.
So in a way, the author of the Gospels is not only, you know, the historical man, whoever it was that wrote Matthew and wrote Mark and Luke, and we know archaeologically that those things borrowed from each other, and they've had some kind of transformation as time goes on. But in a way, what we're talking about supersedes the individual historical context. This is what's present in all of those contexts, and that is this deep fascination with redemption, death, with temptation, with death, with the eternal realm of life. And so it's like there is, in a way, one author that's common to all of us. And so I would say that the reason that the Gospels admit, for instance, the Gospels, I would also say the Bhagavad Gita, right, or you know, the Education of Little Tree, or Black Elk Speaks, or anything else that's a major thing like this, a major text like that, I would say that they admit of the kind of endless metaphorical unfolding that we're going to be involved in here, because they are authored in part by this common human element, this common tendency. I find it difficult to believe that we could just take the words and make them mean anything we wanted, that we would, that, for instance, we're going to see the number 5 a lot in what we do in the Gospels.
And 3.
And we're going to see the number 3 a lot. And we're going to see water. And we're going to see stone and wine. And we're going to see a lot of things a lot. It just seems more than coincidental that this kind of interpretation does begin to flesh out so much, if there weren't this archetypal element, you know, involved. That's, well, I guess Ken's word would be transpersonal. Huh?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's so exciting to me.
Well, I mean, I'm into it. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to start kind of just to, as a jumping off point, you know, we're going to start with one particular story from the Gospels, and then we'll just see where it goes in terms of this particular discussion. And then in subsequent episodes, we'll just pick some stories, or we may even focus on a theme and see how it comes up, you know, again and again. But the story we're going to start with is the miracle at the Pool of Bethesda.
Do you have the passage in the New Testament?
I can get it real quick. I need to just look it up.
All right. So this is John 5, and it starts, saying, after these things, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now there is in Jerusalem by the Sheep Gate a pool which is called in Hebrew Bethesda, having 5 porticos. In these lay a multitude of those who were sick, blind, lame, and withered, waiting for the moving of the waters. For an angel of the Lord went down at certain seasons into the pool and stirred up the water. Whoever then first, after the stirring up of the water, stepped in was made well from whatever disease with which he was afflicted. And a certain man was there who had been 38 years old in his sickness. When Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he had already been a long time in that condition, he said to him, "Do you wish to get well?" The sick man answered him, "Sir, I have no man to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up. But while I am coming, another steps down before me." Jesus said to him, "Arise, take up your pallet, and walk." And immediately the man became well and took up his pallet and began to walk. So that's the basic.
Right.
The basic situation as it's laid out. There's more that comes after that, but why don't we start with that?
Yeah.
So we have a sheep gate.
Right.
Now, given the idea that we have denotative meanings and connotative meanings, or we have objective literal meanings and we have psychological meanings, the possibility for reading this story in terms of both of those has to be there. Okay, so in this situation, we're in Jerusalem and there's a sheep gate, and obviously there were a lot of people that had sheep at that time, or at least some people had sheep, and there were shepherds. But we also know that the idea of the shepherd is more than literal in the gospel, and we also know that the idea of sheep is more than literal, right, in the gospel. And so sheep need a shepherd. So there's this notion here in the beginning that there's a gate, something that is standing between the pool, and that the gate is for sheep. And so sheep need to be led. So I think already this story is set in a context where the vibe has to do with a mass of living beings that need to be shepherded because of some particular condition, right, that they have. You could also say that we're starting in a context where, because of this notion of sheep, which we're taking metaphorically or psychologically now as being important for us to investigate, we could also say that sheep, not only do they need to be led, they are led by something. Sheep kind of is a normative term, you know, for a lot of people. We don't we tend, especially as Americans, right, we don't tend to think of ourselves as sheep. It's not, we prefer not to. And I think that you can make the case that we're sheepish in a whole bunch of ways. And so obviously these folks are being led by something. And this something that they're being led by is intimately connected to the idea that they're lame and they're blind and they're sick and they're withered, to use the language of this particular thing. So for me, the idea of the five porches, if it's set in that context that we have this group of people who are essentially sheep-like, meaning they're led by something, I think that that makes what we're going to eventually say about the porches even more important. Because the sheep state is going to, the sheepish kind of state is going to be connotatively understood as the average everyday state. So one of the questions would be, what are all the sheep here led by? I think the porch answers the question. What is it that's pulling everybody around, and what's showing everybody the way in life? So you want to say something about the porches, and I'll try to make this idea that I've introduced, you know, relate to that.
Right. Well, I mean, I think what we can say in terms of a psychological interpretation of the five porches would be that it refers to the five senses.
It's here we go with the number five. Right. We're going to see it a lot, and
I don't think it's a big. I mean, I don't think that it's a big jump to say that. I mean, what's interesting to me is that as we read these stories, we'll see all these details.
Yeah.
And it's like, why, what, you know, really, what is the significance of that, or why even mention that?
So what do you, this is, I mean, it gets better the deeper we go into it. So, okay, let's take the idea that the five porches are connotatively significant of the five senses. So, you know, what is a porch for? I mean, what do you do?
Sit.
Yeah, what do you do with it? It props you up,
right.
You know. You sit and you lay around on it.
Right.
And so there's five of these porches.
And these sick, blind, halt, and withered people are all...
Propped up
by these porches.
By these porches, which we're going to say are their five senses.
Right.
And so to answer now the connection between what I said about sheep and the five porches... is I think that we could see this as meaning that in the average everyday state, the human is completely dominated and led
by the senses.
Five senses,
right.
And so who's the shepherd of the blind? Sight, sound, smell, taste, that basic thing, the sense of touch. And that means that the real shepherd is aversion to pain and attachment to pleasure.
Right. And so if we're going to be intellectually honest and really take these things on the psychological level, we also might mention that this being sick, blind, halt, and withered may not necessarily, I mean, on the literal sense, meaning blind, withered, you know, halt, sick, but taken psychologically, you know, means possibly something different as well.
I think it has to. I think it has to. And so if we're sheepish in the sense that we're constantly led around by our senses, that means we're not driving the bus. And that also means that we are bound to experience the world in a particular way that may not be conducive to what you and I are calling our creative evolution.
Right. And so if we're talking about creativity and being creative, that requires a certain psychological health, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
And so, taken metaphorically, the sick, blind, and withered could be, you know, those that are in some way unable to access that creativity.
Right, because they take the reality that's constructed for them by their senses to be the only reality or to be the final picture. There's a lot of reasons, you know, not to do that. There are a lot of reasons to do that that have to do with survival. But we're going to make the distinction between surviving and thriving or evolving creatively a lot.
And we've done that on the website already.
Right.
Yeah, and it'll keep coming up.
It'll keep coming up. And so here we are. The first few verses are a description of the average everyday state of the human. And this would mean that if you can't relate to reality in a way that contextualizes your senses as not being the final arbiter of what truth is, then you're halt, you're stopped or stuck in what's possible for you to see. You're lame, you won't be able to run free, you won't be able to move in the way that we're talking about. I think that's fascinating that that can be interpreted that way.
Right. And one of the things, I mean, you know, when I started reading this, when you brought the book, which a lot of this stuff is coming out of a book called The New Man by Maurice Nicole, who we mentioned earlier. And it's exciting, you know, to me as a person who's heard these stories for all his life, you know, to to see it presented in this way.
So
we set the scene.
So we've set the scene, and we have the sick and the blind and the lame, or we have just the average everyday human who has bought in completely to the vision of reality created by his five senses. And he is on the other side of the gate. He can't get through the gate to the pool. So let's take a crack at the pool and say, you know, investigate or look a little bit about what that might mean.
Well, one of the things that we'll say is that water has a certain significance, and water is as a psychological image has a particular meaning that continues to come up, which is a correlation with truth, and a particular kind of truth.
Right. That, okay, so water is connotatively referring to truth, but a particular kind of truth. That's what you said. That's a really interesting and odd notion, because immediately science balks.
Right.
Okay, immediately science says, what do you mean a particular kind of truth? It's either true or it's not true. And so I think all of us can understand that idea. So let's, with that idea that truth might have different senses, that truth might touch us at different levels of our being, and a certain kind of truth, we're not talking about the basic truth that comes via the average relationship to the senses here. We're talking about something that maybe is not quite as obvious. So let me read the passage again. We know that they're sitting on the side of the gate, and we now have talked about their relationship and their symbolic, the blindness and the lameness as being connotatively pointing to their relationship with their senses because of the five porches. In verse 4, it says, "For an angel of the Lord went down at certain seasons into the pool and stirred up the water. Whoever then first, after the stirring up of the water, stepped in was made well, and whatever disease with which he was afflicted." So this is really interesting, because there are two states that the pool resides in, right? One is the calm, placid state, where it hasn't been touched by divinity, and that's the still state. The state that heals, or there's a specific time that we've got to step in the pool, and I think this is really, really interesting, because it goes exactly to what you've said about a certain kind of truth. The state that heals is the state when the water is moving.
Mm-hmm.
So we might say then that the kind of truth that this water metaphor is referring to is a living truth or a moving, changing truth. And that's the only time that it's able to heal you at a particular time. And so in my mind, there's a distinction connotatively here between the kind of truth that science tends to view, and that's a static truth that is contextless and might, doesn't move.
And you might say objective. Denotative would be the kind of words that we're going to use. Yeah,
right. And then we have a fluid truth, a truth that is related to context, which always changes by definition because it's a contextual kind of thing, and that requires a new feeling of ourselves and a new relationship to our data gathering. Mm-hmm. How are we going to gather data in a way through our senses? We know it's going to come in through our senses, but how are we going to contextualize that data that allows us to feel this living, moving truth? Because it's not objective truth that's going to do it for us when we're talking about this message that evidently the gospel is trying to deliver.
Right. So
I think that's the question at this point. Right? To me, we have a living truth metaphorically symbolized by water that has been stirred into action, right, by a divine being, and we step in at that point.
So this is where it gets interesting, too, for me, is because what the passage says is that, what does it say exactly? The first man?
For an angel of the Lord went down at certain seasons into the pool and stirred up the water. Whoever then first, after the stirring up of the water, stepped in, was made well.
Right.
So, from whatever disease with which he was afflicted. What's interesting in my New American Standard Version is that word first is underlined and given a reference. And so that means, please look up the Greek.
So while you're looking up the Greek, I'm going to just kind of give my initial impression of that.
All right.
Because, you know, as we're in this exercise, I mean, you really can't take for granted that anything is there without a particular reason. Okay, so if we're going to go in here and we're going to try and figure out what this stuff might mean psychologically, if we're going to play the game of as if, you know, and be intellectually honest, we can't assume that anything is without some deeper significance. So there's a quote from Hamlet, I believe, right, where it's, the only part of it that I really remember is that the readiness is all there is. Okay? So there's a certain significance to the state you might be in when the water stirs that might allow you to act first, right? To move. There's a certain significance with how you move and how you receive the water when it stirs.
Well, I'm listening, and I'm sort of listening. I have to be honest. I'm looking at this Greek, right, trying to see if it has any significance to what we're saying.
We'll see what it actually means, you know, what the word first, where it's derived from.
Let me hear what you said again.
Well, what I'm saying is that there is a certain quality of receptiveness, you might say, when the waters are stirred that will allow some to move first. And I think that is perhaps what this is pointing out. So, and that the water may stir and you may move, but you may not be able to get there first before it stops moving.
So tell me if I'm right, then that means that psychologically taken, the meaning of first and the Greek word for first is protoklesia. And we can see proto as being a very significant prefix, right, in that particular, protos. Protoklesia is what's before that. So protos means first.
Okay.
So we say that if I'm right about what you're saying, first is referring to a particular disposition of the person who steps in. So the person who steps in is a unique person in that sense, if he is the first. So we might step in and not be the first.
Right?
So the meaning is referring to my disposition and my readiness or openness to being healed. And I have to be the one who is the first one. and that that meaning isn't denotatively taken only, which means I step there before everybody else in time and in space and otherwise. If this is referring to some psychological truth, it means that I am the first one when I stepped in if I am to be healed.
Right, and that there is a particular receptiveness or a particular attitude toward the truth.
I said disposition.
Yeah.
So my so that fills it in finally. My disposition toward truth, here signified by my stepping into the moving pool of water first, my disposition toward truth, which cannot be objective.
It cannot be led by the five senses.
Okay.
Right?
It just gets better. It doesn't say...
Is there anything more in the Greek?
Well, it has... There are denotative meanings here, which means those are foremost, in time, place, order of importance, before, beginning. There's also the value meaning, which means the best, the choicest, right? The best one. And that starts to cross the bridge between connotative and denotative. Right. So like the finest quality of the human, the best one. There's, and then figuratively, there are meanings of rank and dignity contrasted with eschatos, which is the last, an expression in expressions that state that the first shall be last and the last shall be first, meaning those who seem or claim to be first shall be last.
Well, and that's a whole other theme that we'll...
Let's not digress.
Yeah, later.
Let's not digress. And could we say that if I am to be healed, I have to be able to see when to step in? I have to know that the water is moving. I have to know, therefore, that the truth is of a certain nature, and I have to be my best, or I have to be the choicest of me.
And I have to be ready.
And I have to, or I have to be ready, you might say willing.
Willing.
And that's,
going to be super powerful here in a few minutes, I think, as we move through this. But the willing part is I think, a big piece to the equation.
Okay. All right. So we're going on, and then we just find mention of this particular character in the story, the sick guy who is here. He's laying on a pallet. In some versions it says he's laying on a bed. Okay, and a certain man was there who had been 38 years in his sickness. When Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he had already been a long time in that condition, he said to him, "Do you wish to get well?" The sick man answered him, "Sir, I have no man to put me into the pool where the water is stirred up. But while I am coming, another steps down before me." Jesus said unto him, "Arise, take up your bed and walk." Nicole says something about this that is very subtle, and I wouldn't have particularly gotten. And so I'm wondering right now if we might, I'd have to go back and spend some time thinking about this, but the number 38 might be really interesting to look at.
Yeah, and I was going to say, I'm not sure where to start with the 38.
But I don't know what to do with that right now, so let's put that as an aside, and you guys look for a post on the blog if we can find anything.
Or if you've got any insight into it, make a comment.
If you have any insight into it. So we know that the man is sick. We know that he's been a long time in that condition, and that condition here refers to a particular condition, which means relating to your senses as if they were an objective reality. Thereby, your conception of truth can only be determined by that. Thereby, your conception of truth is not fluid. It's objective. Thereby, you can't get further. You can't get in to the moving water. So he's been in that condition for a really long time. Now Jesus awakens in him by asking him a question. Do you wish to get well?
I think it might be interesting just to wonder about this, because we don't really know. It doesn't say specifically, denotatively, where the man is in relation to the porches and the pool.
I'm assuming, I know he's lying on a bed, You know, I know that, but
Nicole,
I'm...
Nicole, I mean, I'll just say this. One thing that I noticed in Nicole was that he... I'm not sure where he gets it, you know, and I don't want to run the risk of being intellectually dishonest.
Right.
But it's an interesting thing to consider is that, you know, Nicole seems to be convinced or seems to take the meaning that the man is not on one of the porches, but sort of in this middle ground between the porches and the pool.
Well, so I guess because it doesn't say he's on the porches, we at least could wonder about whether or not.
And so the one way to look at that, I guess a psychological way of looking at that, is that here is a man who is caught between being led by the senses and the moving truth.
Well, he's primed and ready.
Right.
You know, you might say...
That's the point.
How do we know? Number one, it doesn't say he's on one of the porches, but he's still lying down and being propped up and supported by something, so he's lame. But number two, he's in the presence of Jesus. And so the reading connotatively also means reading Jesus connotatively. It's very easy for us to consider him a historical man, and you know, I think there are many good reasons to do that. But what could Jesus mean?
Well,
psychologically. So he is in the presence of Jesus, and now whatever Jesus means psychologically has spoken directly
right.
to this man.
So that is really significant, because if we were to take just a couple of minutes and talk about Jesus psychologically from a higher, more collective, you know, unconscious type standpoint.
I was going to look
at the point that Nicole makes. Specifically is that, and he makes this point because he says that Christ, the words Christ and Jesus are used very carefully throughout the Gospels.
Yeah.
And they're used in different ways at specific times. And so we shouldn't overlook the significance of that.
That's right.
And the argument that he makes is that Jesus refers to what he says is the good in man. And that Christ refers to the truth of the word, right?
Mm.
So where you see Christ, he argues that what you're hearing about is the word, the teaching. And that where you see Jesus interacting with people is the good of the truth. And so this is going to be a significant theme throughout our discussions, is this idea of the good and the true. And we are not going to be able to get to the bottom of it at this point, but
no,
it bears kind of talking about a little bit, I think, that you can know the truth, right? But if you don't understand the good of it, then it's incomplete in a way.
Right? You're still stuck.
You're still stuck. And mm-hmm. so I think that the significance of that in this particular story is that we might say from a psychological interpretation that this man is stuck. You know, he knows the truth.
Given to
him by his senses. And he sees the truth, but he still does not yet know the good of it. And I think this is where the will comes into it.
Mm.
Because this is what you said about being willing,
mm-hmm.
right? And it's so interesting because it's a distinction that's so easily passed over, because we think we know what's good. Well, sure. But how many of you really do what's good
yeah.
all the time?
You right.
know, or how many of you really want to do the right thing?
Right.
I don't know, man.
Oh, well, if I speak for myself, we have a whole nother podcast. So let's just say I'm working on it, guys.
Right. But the significance of Jesus is that when he speaks, he's showing you the good of the truth. And the only way that your, whatever, you know, we might call your psychological growth is complete is when you understand the good of the truth that you know, because that's the only way you're going to willingly act on it every time.
Well, I don't want to cut you off, but this opens up a connection to the material that's already been written about extensively on the blog when it comes to creative evolution. And if you, given what Nicole also says about Jesus, the distinction between Jesus and Christ, and so the good always appeals to man's emotional nature, and the truth always appeals to man's intellectual nature. And so at this particular point, what has happened with this man is that Jesus has appeared. So the good of the truth has appeared, and he's now being touched at his emotional level. And that's the level where your motivation comes from. We've talked about that extensively on the blog in your, I think, post about, I think you wrote the post about how difficult it is to have a new experience because of emotions becoming mechanical. And we know that emotions control our motivation, you know, over time. So this aspect of the divine word speaking to the man is touching him, you know, at that particular level, at the only level where it's possible to get fuel for this process.
And this, again, not to cut you off, but I think this relates exactly to our point about the willingness and the certain attitude, or what was your word? The
disposition.
Disposition. The particular disposition requires this emotional understanding.
It requires that because, you know, let's paint the other side for intellectual honesty. What Jesus didn't say here is, hey, you know what? Your five senses are getting in the way. And if you'll just listen to me, I'll tell you what's wrong and you'll know it. So then you'll be able to get up and go. He didn't say that. He didn't paint an objective picture of what's going on here with the guy. He said,
What do you want?
Right. What do you want? Let's go. Let's touch that particular place. If within the confines of the picture we're painting here, telling the man how it is wouldn't motivate him at all. Wouldn't give him the power to get up and do what he said. So we have the voice of the good of truth, the embodiment of the good of truth, which is Jesus at this point, speaking to this man who has been had a spell cast on him by his senses. And maybe he's ripe for the teaching because he's not on a porch. Maybe he's just like, for 38 years,
he's been right on the edge,
and now he's in a place where he can hear it finally.
Right.
For whatever reason.
And furthermore, I mean, the point was made that he doesn't. That he's been slow. He's been slow on the uptake.
Mm-hmm.
Every time he makes a go at it, somebody else steps in first.
You know, one of the subtle things I was going to say here has to do with the use of the word man. I have no man.
Well, yeah, I was going
to pick me up and put me in the water. And so his understanding is that he can't get up on his own.
I need a guru.
That he has to have somebody else do it. So I think that is psychologically significant of his disposition being denotative at this point.
And Christ, you know, makes that point a number of times with his disciples about believing in the man, you know, of Christ, or believing in the word, you know, the teaching. You know, Nicole would say the entire story of Christ is about learning to trust yourself and not looking externally, which again would be the five senses. He says here, though, that this man is always too slow, is always second and never first. And this is just talking about what we had said, which was that a man who acts only from truth is acting from what is second in him. And if he acts from his will, he is acting from what is first in him. And Jesus gives him the power to act from his will, which is the power to take up the bed of truth and walk and do it and live it.
So knowledge is feeble for that. Knowledge alone is feeble for that.
Right.
Some creativity is needed.
And I think you're right that the line about I have no man to pick me up is significant because of what I said about, you know, this whole, you know, this entire story is about, from a psychological standpoint, is about self-reliance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, Nicole says that the whole teaching in the gospel is that we have the potential to be unique. We have the potential to be ourselves.
Right.
And that we are evolving, you know, to that particular place.
And that's what the blog is about and what, you know.
That's right. So, Jesus said to him, "Arise, take up your pallet and walk." And immediately the man became well and took up his pallet and began to walk.
Immediately.
Immediately. Man, awesome. After 38 years.
Where can I get that?
Nicole makes a lot out of what the bed is that this guy is lying in. So his general disposition would be defined by the porches, which are in the way.
Right. And furthermore, Nicole says something about it. It's that the bed is psychologically significant to what a man lies in. His beliefs.
His beliefs.
Which, if they are driven by the senses, then they are inadequate.
They're limiting.
They're of a certain nature, right.
They're of a certain nature. They're not conducive to maybe this felt connection with a fluid truth about reality.
They don't create the disposition toward that truth that would allow you to act immediately.
Right.
From the good of truth that you know.
So he takes up his bed. In other words, he picks up his beliefs. He picks up the things that are deposited in his memory and carries them.
Right.
Instead of them supporting him.
That's right.
And he didn't need to get in the water.
Right. Notice there's no mention of him getting into the water.
Everything he thought that had to happen didn't happen. I think that's also very, very important. The water was there for him as a draw, and that's what he believed needed to happen.
Well, and I think it says something too about, you know, that the truth, you know, there we'll talk about, I mean, the kingdom is within you, and the word, you know, is in you.
Mm-hmm.
And so in a sense that, you know, this is a man who knows the truth, right? So it really comes back to that whole knowledge versus emotion in a way.
If what we're saying has any relevance at all, in a way, we could refine that a little bit by saying we all are the truth in some real sense that can be fortifying, some real sense that is helpful, some real sense that is related to creativity and relating to our senses in a particular way. So we all are the truth. Whether we know that truth or not may not be as significant as the fact that we are that we can't not be that. You know, I'm thinking of Maharaj of Nisargadatta, Maharaj, when he said that probably the one thing that stands out more than anything else from I Am That for me is that you can't ever know yourself.
Right.
You can only be what you are.
Right.
What you know of yourself is what you're not. That's always the case. And so it's always just beyond the level of knowing. It's always trans-knowing. It can be realized, which has a different sense, but the truth being within, for me, connotatively means that I am
right.
Truth in some sense. The fact that I can't know it in the way that normal knowing is can bring me to despair. I will say that it has brought me to despair many, many times, but then not being able to shed that sense has also, number two, kept me going. And number three, it might be possible to be mature about that sense in a way to where you have peace, where you come to grips with your knowing and its limits, and you understand that it's like a screwdriver in the toolbox and it's not good for, you know, driving nails.
Right.
You don't try to use it for something that it can't do.
Yeah. Well, so that's the miracle at Bethesda. And I'm not sure what we're going to do next time, but we might as well just call this episode one. And we're interested in anything, any thoughts that this brings up with the listeners. Anything in particular that maybe you would like to hear more about, you know, let us know in the comments. Send us an email, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for listening. And
right on.
Thanks for participating, Matt.
Okay, and thanks for the opportunity.
Uh-huh.